Welcome to Journeys of Romance. I'm your host, Jess Michaels. My next guest was a motion picture agent. She's an attorney specializing in creatives, an industry guru, and a USA Today bestselling author of contemporary romance. I think we met at the Laura chapter of RWA, and she's one of my very favorite people in the whole world. So please welcome the remarkable Maggie Marr.
Oh, thank you. That's so nice of you. What a nice opening.
Now you have to live up to that. So
I know. There's a little bit of pressure that comes with that.
Yeah, no pressure, but, you know, you're my favorite person. So
I feel the same way. I was just thinking about when you were at OCC, I think it was like a couple years ago.
Yeah.
And when you were speaking and feeling so much pride at having worked with you as you were standing there giving your speech, it was really this wonderful feeling
See you up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you were so helpful to me. I mean, the background of us is that I had books with Sam Hain, and I wanted to get those rights back. And I, you know, knew that you were a literary attorney, which you're amazing at. And so I reached out to you, and you looked over the contracts, and then you kind of gave me a guideline of how to sort of approach that. You know, because saying I have an attorney and I want my rights back is kind of the nuclear option. So, and it worked. I mean, you know, the way that I kind of addressed it based on sort of your advice worked. So, I mean, you know, I always recommend you to everyone. When anyone says literary attorney, I'm like, Maggie Marr.
Thank you. That's like the biggest compliment I think anybody can get, right?
Well, I think the fact that you're an author really gives you a different viewpoint on that. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, no, I've heard that. It's funny. I have one client who called me up one time and said, so I have a business attorney. She had a business attorney who did all like their estate work and things like that. And she said, but he doesn't understand what I want. She said, you're an author and an attorney. I want to pay you to talk to him and translate what I tell you so that he understands what I want. You can turn it from like author language to legal language. And I said, well, I'll do that for you. I'm not going to charge you for that, but I'll be happy to try to make that translation between the two things, you know? So I definitely come at it from a different perspective.
And I think, you know, the first time that I sort of saw that difference was with, you know, a literary agent versus like an attorney looking at a contract, because any attorney who looked at, especially contracts back when I started in publishing, would just be like, don't sign that, you know, and a literary agent sort of understood the difference, because our industry is so weird. We have a weird industry. It doesn't fit in a lot of other ways. Maybe all creative industries are sort of like that.
It's true. I mean, it's funny because when I do agreements, because I do have a lot of clients in film and TV, because I, you know, I was in that world and still inhabit that world. And so there are certain things in different agreements, both for publishing and for film and TV, that are kind of standard. And they're not going to get moved or changed or shifted. And I think attorneys who have that background understand where you've got template language that you're not going to be able to shift. And where you can. But part of the job, in my opinion, a huge part of the job, is to explain to my clients what that language means, what they're giving up, what they're getting in return, and really getting an understanding of what the client wants and needs from the deal. So, I mean, that's the key component for me, is because I've had clients say to me, look, I'm going to sign this deal no matter what. Like, even if it takes my firstborn, I'm going to sign this deal. And I'll say, okay, but I need to make sure that you understand that they're taking your firstborn and your secondborn. And here are all the other things they're going to take, you know, on top of that.
Right.
So, but it ultimately is always the client's decision. It's just, I have to make sure that they're well informed, because nobody wants a surprise 6 months, 9 months, a year later from an agreement that they thought their attorney or their agent vetted. And I've had those clients where they come back and they're like, I have no idea that this is what I signed. And that's sad. That makes me sad.
Well, and it's funny too, because, you know, contracts that we signed back 10 years ago or 15 years ago. I mean, I signed my first contract in 2004. You know, it was so different from, the opportunities were so different. And so signing away my firstborn, secondborn, and, you know, my cat was, you know, it felt like, well, this is the best option, you know. And now looking back in retrospect, in a way that, to be fair, my agent never could have guessed either. You know, I mean, you know, now that stuff is signed away and I can't get it back at this point, unless they choose to let me have it back. You know, I mean, there's no there's really no exit clause almost in those contracts. So, cause we've tried, you know, and so it's like that's the thing too, is, you know, you're looking at, here's something from 20 years ago versus something today. I mean, I would never sign away those things now because I know what the opportunities are. I mean, it's hard to read the crystal ball and say, oh, in 15 years, there's going to be indie publishing. You're going to want all this stuff back.
Exactly. Although I got lucky, my first two books, that came out through Random House, those books came back to me because they were coming back to me before the ebook market kind of took off.
You hit the sweet spot.
I did. There are a lot of times when I did not hit a sweet spot, but in that situation, I totally did hit the sweet spot and got those rights back right as it was, well, before it was starting.
Yeah. You know? When they still sort of, they didn't see that coming. Mm-mm. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting because I think you have such a unique path to publishing and creativity that I almost didn't know how to organize all my thoughts about it. So let's go backward. So were you always an avid reader?
I was, yeah, as a kid, you know, it was my form. I'm an introvert who pretends to be an extrovert.
Me too.
Yeah. In a family that when it got together could be very loud and extroverted. So it was really easy for me. I think a lot of kids do this. You escape with a book.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you can be in like a huge place with a lot of people and be left alone.
Right. Because people see you reading and they're like, oh, you know, I'm not going to bother her.
And they're actually like A-okay with it too, right? Like it's mm-hmm. different than if you're playing a game or anything like that. They're like, oh yeah, that kid needs to be left alone because they are making their brain smarter, you know?
Yeah. It's an acceptable form of putting a cage around yourself that says, don't touch me.
So I did that as a kid, you know, and so I was a huge reader.
So when did you start reading romance? When did you make the transition to reading romance?
So I read romance. My mom was a big romance reader. And she was a stay-at-home mom. So when we were little, she would read a lot, like while we were doing other things. And she mm-hmm. always kept her books. So I was diving into those books. I think I was reading romance probably around like 8, 9, 10. Any book that I would find, I could read. And it really wasn't until I got, I think it was probably sixth grade, I figured out that there were some books in her closet that were not kept.
The no-no books.
Right. In the rest of the house. And I remember one of them in particular was Wifey. And I think that's by Judy Blume. And I remember, I found it and I went to my mom. I said, oh, I'm going to read this one. And she said, no, you're not. And I said,
all the color goes out of her face.
Yeah, she's like, no, you're not going to read that book. And so, of course, you know, I found it and I read it. You know, I snuck the book because when you tell a 12-year-old not to do something, it's like waving a red flag. And I think that was the first time I really figured out that there was there were certain things in books. All the books before, either I didn't notice the sex or there wasn't much sex in it. But Wifey was one of those books that had some of that content in it that I actually like clued into that.
How old were you when you read that one?
I think I was 12. I think middle school.
So, but kind of the right age of like you're sort of starting to, like you're starting to go into puberty. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Did you know a babysitter that summer who had a copy of Forever?
Mm.
And I remember asking my mom if I could read that too, and she said no. And so then, of course, I read that. You know, I grabbed that book as well. And I've gone back and read that because I have a teenager, and it is, without a doubt, one of the tamest books you could read right now in comparison to some of the other YA books that come out. I was like, wow, this was the book that everybody was rocking everybody's world.
Well, and so, but it's a different time, right? Yeah. I mean, you know, you wouldn't have.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose there were things that were happening at that time, you know, I mean, certain romances where it probably wasn't tame, but, you know, there was a fervor about that book. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I mean, in comparison to some of the things that are out today, it's really very different.
Mm-hmm. It's really interesting how that has changed. Because in my mind, I was comparing it to, I went back and reread it because, like I said, I have a teenager and I was like, well, I guess I should be aware of what I was not supposed to be reading. And in comparison, like I read a copy of one of the Gossip Girl books, which is forever ago, I know. But when you read them back to back like that, it's a little shocking.
Right. It's much more stark, the difference.
To see the difference.
So, yeah.
I'm sorry, I got off track. You asked me if I was a big reader.
No, but I mean, I think it is interesting, you know, just thinking about, because a lot of the authors who I've spoken to in the podcast have talked about reading things like The Babysitter's Club or mm-hmm. Sweet Valley High or like Judy Blume, and mm-hmm. that those are kind of gateway drugs to romance in a way, because for they sure. do have the emotional content, and that's the thing that I think romance feeds into.
And then I went through that phase, and I don't know if everybody goes through it, but I did for sure when I was in college, where I was much too fancy or thought I was for romance, mm-hmm. you know, where I'm like, oh no, I'm only reading the classics and the literary books.
Only
and,
literary fiction.
Yes, I got very fancy, as one does when you are that age, you know. Sure. And that's fine, you know, in retrospect, I kind of giggle at that person who was me. But then, you know, and then there was work, and it's funny, I found my way back to romance with the birth of my second child, and it had a lot to do with desperately want, but with the first one, I still worked full time as an agent, right? So, mm-hmm. so I still was reading like, I don't know, 20 or 30 scripts a week and books for my job. So reading like the scripts and the books and all that would keep me really busy with my reading addiction. With the second one, I was staying home and I wanted to read, but it was, had to be like these smaller bits of time. And a script had always been perfect because you could read a script in a couple hours.
Right.
And so I was like, what am I? And so I was in the library, I think, one day, because I love libraries. And they have this whole, like, carol that is romance. And I just started pulling them out and became that. I picked that drug right back up. You know what I mean? Like, it really was. It was like a drug that just came right, roaring right back from when I had been reading that stuff. Yeah, from, like, junior high and high school and in the beginning of college. So it just, I was like, oh, yeah, I love this. And started writing it. You know?
So you started writing it when you were home with your second child?
Yeah. You know, the first two books that I wrote when I was a junior agent, and they were more women's fiction. And then after the second one was born, the first book had come out, I don't think the second one had, and went back to reading romance, and it was a good friend of mine, Allie Carter, who said, you should write a romance. She mm-hmm. said, you would really be good at that. And so I did. And I love it. And have never looked back, really, at all.
Well, it's funny. I mean, you know, there aren't a lot of romance writers who really leave romance. I mean, there's mm-hmm. a handful of obviously very big people that, you know, they went on to write thrillers or whatever. But, mm-hmm. I mean, it does feel like once you start writing romance, you may try different flavors of a romance, different genres in the genre. But, like, that satisfying emotional ending, I think, is really powerful, and mm-hmm. I wouldn't want to write something that didn't have it. So I can't picture myself writing something that isn't romance at this point.
Yeah, and here's the thing, is that even if I were to say want to call something women's fiction, because, you know, I believe that there are a lot of romances anymore that really do center around the woman's story. Mm-hmm. But I too need that satisfying, happy ending, because I want that for all the people that I love.
Yeah.
And I can't. Yes. And, you know, we were talking about, you know, controlling the world. And I can't control that for everyone that I love. I can't give them that happy ending for whatever is happening in their life. So when I write, I can give it to my characters. And I can give it to all the people who are kind enough to read my books. I can give them that moment that I long for everyone that I care about. You know, maybe that's why.
Yeah, I feel like that's what I do too. I control mm-hmm. through romance. So, I mean, even when things are bad, I can kind of enter into that world. And I know that no matter how bad I make the situation, the setup.
Right.
I will get them out of the tree at some point. Horrible. And they'll be okay.
You make their lives in the book. I do that too. I'm trying to get better at it because have you had the experience where you're like, oh, I don't want to do that to them?
I have. It's like, oh, I feel so bad. I remember writing at some point, probably on Facebook or something, that I was writing a moment in a book for the heroine, and yeah. I felt bad because she didn't know it was going to be okay. And I knew, but she didn't know. And I wished, you know, I like wished I could tell her it was going to be okay. And so every once in a while I do get that feeling where I'm like, oh no,
and it makes
sorry.
For a better book. Right? Like, yeah. You know, if you're hating what you're doing to them, that your reader is going to be compelled to keep reading,
Yes.
But those moments are hard. Like, mm-hmm. there are times when you're writing what's happening to someone in the book, and we're talking about pretend characters.
Yeah,
and whole
cloth made up.
I'm, like, crying. I'm like, this is horrible. How come this person has to go through this, and I'm the one typing the story?
Do you ever try to avoid it? Because I the book that I have coming out in November, which I think by the time this airs, it will have already come out, but it's the last book in a series, and the hero's father has been very sick throughout the whole series, and for him to become Duke, the last Duke, he has to, you know, the father has to die, mm-hmm. you have to kill him. And I had written, and I texted our friend Jen LeBlanc, who was the first person that I had on this podcast, and I said, it's not working, and I don't know what to do, and can we talk for a minute, like, talk through it? So she called me, and I said, this is what I'm doing, and she goes, have you killed him on screen yet? And I was like, no. She goes, well, there you go. Like, I hate you. Bye. And I just hung up on her and, like, went and wrote it. Because I didn't want to write it. Like, I didn't want to write it. But I think it's a better book for it.
It's so true. And I'll find everything to do but the thing that I don't want to write. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I will do laundry like nobody's business if I don't want to write something.
Time to clean the grout. That grout is so dirty.
You know, we haven't cleaned this garage in a while. We should do that. Yeah. Well, it's good to know we all do it. Yep. I don't know.
Yep.
But again, I think you're right. I mean, like, if I have become so involved emotionally, I know I'm doing the right thing because, you know, I know that I'm tapping into something that bothers me or, you know, moves me. And so hopefully that translates more on the page than any other time.
The writing is better that way, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the books that are more cause me more pain tend to get my readers more excited. You know, it's the conveyance of human emotion, I think, through words, basically.
Yeah. And that's what we're all reaching for. I mean, the emotion, as much as the happily ever after, the emotion is such the core of romance that, you know, that's what we're trying to do here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe more than any other genre.
So that gateway drug, man, I picked that thing right back up.
And here we are.
Yeah, here we are.
So, I mean, you were working for International Creative Management, ICM, which is a talent agency in Hollywood, and you were a motion picture literary agent, which I'm assuming means you helped kind of market books to producers to make them into movies. Is that
It's a kind really of fancy title to say that basically I worked in the movie world, and I there were three populations that I would represent. I worked with directors of movies and screenplay writers, and then I would work to sell books into film and TV. Mm-hmm. So subsidiary rights, and those were kind of the three. And then the other thing is big agencies like that, even though I was specializing in film, working with directors and screenplay writers instead of, say, actors, you would get placed on teams because really big actors would want agents who were familiar with great directors and great material and great books that they could talk to about scripts that I had read or books that I had seen or things like that, you know? Because when an actor is at that level, it's more about finding the right material. It's not necessarily about it's not necessarily that they need a job. It's that they want the right material. So,
they can become more choosy.
Mm-hmm.
It's really like what material speaks to them versus, who wants me?
Yeah, so it's like vetting the material, looking at the material, you know, and then when you're agenting, a lot of it is you're really trying to find your clients the right job, you know, you're trying to find them work, and you're trying to take the things that they've created and find a home for it, you know, somebody that will buy the things that they've created. So
I mean, really, it's such a different kind of creativity in a way because, you know, even though you weren't necessarily, I mean, you were writing, but you weren't creating in that job, you were working with the creativity branches of so many people and trying to bring those branches together.
It was super interesting. And it's, I remember, because I had practiced law before we moved out here, because we moved out here, my husband is an actor, and we moved out here for him. And so I wanted to be in that industry, and I did all kinds of research and reading about the entertainment industry, and everything said, go and work in an agency, work as an assistant in an agency. So I did. And the day I started in the mailroom, you know how they all joke how everybody starts in the mailroom, and I did. I'd been an attorney, I'd litigated, I'd had my own office, I'd done all that stuff, and
you're working in a mailroom.
But the day I started, there were six other people in the mailroom with me. One had a PhD, and five of them were attorneys.
Wow.
And we're all working in the mailroom, because that's how you work your way up.
Right.
But it was like a graduate degree in entertainment, because mm-hmm. entertainment, the industry itself, has its own kind of specific set of dance steps and rules as far as how everybody kind of interacts with each other. And it was great. It was amazing to do. The hours were tough. The pay was awful. But the people that you meet and the access that you get, it was priceless in every single way.
It's like a master class. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so then when you took time off from that and were having your kids and sort of, you know, focusing on your family maybe more and then writing, do you feel like that helped you as a writer?
Oh, yeah, for sure. You know, it was interesting. I got caught in this weird sort of place. So when I had my first daughter, I continued to work, and then I sold the first two books. And the first book I had written just when I couldn't sleep or on vacation or whatever. And the second book had a deadline. And that's when I exited the agency as an agent. But they kept me as a client. And so I was actually going out to pitch for TV myself as a writer when the strike hit. That's how old I am. And so I got kind of caught up in that. And so I thought, well, you know, but I write books. It'll be fine. The funny thing is that having been a representative, a lot of my clients would still reach out to me about projects, contracts, negotiations, things like that. And since I had my law degree, I could still do those types of things and have those conversations. And so everything that I've done feels like it's always been kind of organic. Like one thing has led to another. And my husband has been so important, because oftentimes I'll be doing something, not realizing what I'm doing. And it will be my husband who says, why aren't you turning this into a legal practice? You know, why aren't you turning this into a media company? Mm-hmm. You know, and it's him watching me from outside of myself saying, you're doing all these things already. I have a tough time kind of acknowledging what's going on, because I've got my head down doing the work, I guess.
Yeah, so. I feel the same way. I mean, it's, you know, having a partner that is supportive and sort of involved. I mean, my partner works for me now. So, but yeah, I mean, he can see that like 20,000 foot view, and I'm like right in the middle of everything. And so, I mean, he will sometimes say, you know, well, what about this? What about this? And I immediately will be like, no. And then, of course, as I think about it, I'm like, yeah, no, you're right. You're right.
I do that too. It's that resistance, right? It's that resistance to stepping into your own truth or power or whatever you want to call it, I think, and really acknowledging what you're already doing. But I do believe that having read, because when I was agenting, I would read so much, so many scripts every weekend, so many books, just constant, like this constant influx of great material, not great material, but yet still always reading. And I can't help but think that if you're really reading that much stuff, that if you have a ability or propensity to also want to create story, that you're internalizing some of those structures and what makes a good story and what doesn't make a good story.
Right, because you're analyzing it from such a different view as a thinking about like where that story could go. So you're analyzing it differently than if you're just a reader. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a really interesting point. You know, I hadn't really thought about it that way, that, you know, as an agent, you know, or an editor, you know, it's the same thing. I mean, you're pulling out pieces of structure. And so you're learning that, you know, and maybe taking it to your own work.
Mm-hmm. Although there is, I think, also this thing I was talking to another author recently about. There is something, though, about the actual practice of things, meaning that I can watch somebody else do the dance steps and think to myself, oh, yeah, I can dance like that. Mm-hmm. But you still have to actually do the work. Right. So while I might have internalized a lot of things about structure and story and how to make something so you have to read it, you know, or tension and plot, you still have to sit down and actually write the words, edit the words, rewrite the words. You have to do that work, because I don't think you just for very few people does it just flow out effortlessly.
Yeah, it's all application, mm-hmm. for sure. Which is why I think, you know, taking, it's the same thing with taking classes at RWA, mm-hmm. or, you know, reading craft books. I mean, if you're not then taking that and applying it, mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, it's not really useful knowledge until you're applying.
I agree. I think that's completely right. And it never, I don't think it ever stops, right? I think you get maybe a greater confidence, meaning that there's always this piece or part of a book where I think to myself, oh my golly, I'm never going to get through this. Whether or not I have written an outline or not written an outline, you know, there's this moment where I cannot see how I'm going to bridge this gap between mm-hmm. what I know is the ending and where I am in the usually end of the second act, somewhere at the beginning of the third act.
Yes, kind of in that middle.
Right.
Yeah, and you're like, I'm the worst at this ever. That's what I always do. I am the worst at this.
This is ridiculous. Why do
I do this? How have I ever tried to think that I was good at this?
Even though you have, like, what, 100 books behind you?
I mean, like,
you
know, 70 books, yeah. And I'm like, I suck.
I cannot get this. So I think that the drama, for me at least, gets a little bit less. Although every book is so different and every character or couple is so different that mm-hmm. I will think, oh, but this one is the one that's really going to do me in. You know, this one is the one that I'm not going to be able to finish.
Yeah, this one's the one where it's all over. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I'll be exposed as the fraud I know I am.
Mm-hmm. Fear and fraud, man. They are some evil girls.
Absolutely. They are the voice in your girls. Head is always a thousand times worse than anybody else's voice.
I joke about that, how fear and fraud are like the mean girls that follow me around when I'm tired or in the middle of a book.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's, I mean, that's why I think having a community of writers, we were talking about this a little bit mm-hmm. before we started recording, is so important. Because if I say to you, oh my God, I feel like a fraud, if you say to me, no, you're not, like, that's nice. But if you say, oh my God, I feel like a fraud too, then I'm like, oh, okay, all right, then I'm good. Mm-hmm. It almost is more helpful to hear that everyone feels like they're a fraud, or that everyone hits that wall at some point in the book, even if we have a different wall that we hit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. There's a sense of tribe that comes with, and I have to say that I was really glad when I found it. It made me super happy, and it came to me through RWA. I came to RWA already published,
yeah,
which is kind of a different way to enter. A lot of people come up through RWA building their ability to write, but it's also this group of people who, when I talk to them about hearing the characters talk to me in my head, don't ask me if I've taken my medicine. You know what I mean? Like, they don't think that is so strange.
They don't get that.
Mm-hmm. Or if I exit from if I'm at a writer's retreat or a writer's event and I say, I've got to go upstairs right now and write this down. They don't, that's fine. Of course.
Right. Normal people say, mm-hmm. really? Because we're in the middle of dinner. And writers go, oh my God, yes, I have paper. Do you need a pen?
Do you need a pen right now? There's an empty table.
Do you
want
to just go in the corner and do that?
Do you want to tell me the words? I'll write them for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Dictate to me. Yeah. Is your brain going too fast? Like, yeah, we do. We all kind of get that mm-hmm. that feeling.
And also the other
And that's
feelings.
Actually been something really nice about doing this, you know, having mm-hmm. these conversations with so many different authors at so many different points in their career, you know, with so many different backgrounds is you see the differences, and that's really interesting. And then you also see the commonality, which mm-hmm. is very comforting.
Mm-hmm. And I feel,
and I think we get that from RWA too.
Yeah. And I feel particularly blessed because I get to see so many interesting facets of the creative industry. You know, I get to, and I don't take it lightly or granted in any way, I get to be friends with some of the most amazing authors I've ever known in my life. Right. I get to actually, and I can say this honestly, when I was an agent, I would meet celebrities and I never got tongue tied around actors. But when I would get on the phone with writers, there were times when it would be hard to speak, you know, because you're like, oh my God, I'm talking to, you know, one of my mentors actually had a George R.R. Martin as a client.
Mm-hmm,
you know, so, you know, but you're on the phone, and those were the types of people that would make me a little bit unable to talk.
Do you think that's because you had aspirations mm-hmm, to do
probably,
that?
Yeah,
that
it... of course, I think. Because, you know, I'd always written, but I grew up in the Midwest, and people didn't become writers. They became attorneys, right. You know, if you're good with words. So, And so agent felt like a perfect fit, you know? Mm-hmm. And again, it was my husband who was like, you know, that book you've been working on, if somebody would sell that book, we could pay for preschool.
Yeah. Again, though, I mean, I think it's needing that push from an outside source. You know, I mean, Michael kind of did the same thing where he said, yeah, you're happy when you're writing and you're not happy doing anything else. I don't understand why you're not just writing, and just kind of pushed me over the cliff. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with when I went indie, which, I mean, you started out with Random House, mm-hmm, with your first two books, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. And so you were traditionally published. Mm-hmm. What was the path to that?
To independent?
Well, either one, yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you're traditionally published, and I'm assuming that probably comes from, well, first off, it was 2006, 2007, yeah, when there really wasn't an option.
Yeah, no, it wasn't. You know, the first one, the first two sold, it's funny, it's a good story. It was, I was a coward, and I had been, you know, I was a baby agent, I'd been writing when I couldn't, you know, these books or whatever, when I couldn't sleep, or, and Chad, you know, my husband said, you know, if you sell these, we could pay for preschool, because baby agents don't make a lot of money. And I said, no, I'm an agent. This is what I'm going to do. This is what I want to be. And he said, okay, you know, whatever. So I sent it to a colleague out of New York who represented book authors, because we would exchange material. She would have book authors that wrote scripts. I would have screenplay writers that wrote books. And so we would see if we couldn't sell or get something going for.
Yeah, the partnership makes sense. Yeah.
And I didn't put my name on it because I didn't want to put her in any sort of weird position if she read it and was like, oh, I don't know what to do with this. So I gave it to her like on a Thursday, and she called me on a Monday, and she's in New York and I'm in LA, and she says, oh my God, who wrote this? I can sell this. Who wrote this? And I said, do you really want to know who wrote this? And she said, you wrote this.
And you were outed.
Yeah, and I said, I absolutely did write it. She said, is it finished? I said, no, but it can be. And she said, if you finish it, I'll sell it. I said, okay.
Wow.
So I finished it, and it sold in a way that things never sold. There was a bidding war between two houses.
Oh, wow.
And she took it out under a pseudonym in case it didn't sell, so that I could still remain an agent, right? So sure. We were all being protective of what I thought was going to be my future, my entire life. But it did sell, and it sold for a handsome sum of money. And it was her mentor and a woman that I dearly love who said to her, who wrote this? I know it was one of the agents. Who wrote it? You just sold it for a gob of cash. Who wrote it? And she told her, and she said, well, you tell Maggie that I'm sending out the deal memo under her name. And so she's got 30 minutes to tell whoever she needs to tell in LA that there's a book that she sold.
Wow, she just threw you out into the ocean.
And so I go to my mentor then at the time, who was the head of the motion picture department, literary side, and I said, oh, so I, you know, I walk in, I'm really anxious, and I said, I need to tell you I sold a book. And he looks at me and he goes, oh, that's great, what studio?
He didn't understand. Yes.
And I said, no, you don't understand what I'm telling you. What I'm saying is I wrote the book and it sold, and the deal memo is going to come out under my name. And he didn't even, nobody knew I wrote.
Right.
You know, and he's like, that's fabulous. That's fantastic. And it went out, and the head of the agency called me that day. And I was used to being a baby agent where you would get a phone call that was like, do X, Y, and Z click, you know, because it was so fast. Our phone mm-hmm. calls, because you do like 200 a day as an agent.
Yep.
And that day the phone rang. It was, I got the agent schmoozing me. You know what I mean? And it was like through the looking glass. And I went home early because I was like, I do not know how to deal with.
I can't even function.
I can't deal with these people that are so used to telling me what to do as a baby agent, calling me up. I mean, it was lovely, but it was very different to be
feel comfortable.
That client when I was used to being their fellow patriot. You know what I mean? Like, I went from being, you know, the person in the
a
box,
colleague
to a client.
In that well, and so quickly, too, because mm-hmm. you were going along in your life, and you're like, okay, if I sell this, I'm not going to do it under my name, and suddenly it's all you.
Yeah, so the transition from that to indie was that the book sold for a lot of money. There was the crash in 2008. Nobody really wanted to read about fancy shoes and expensive cars.
Yeah.
So the books did okay, but they didn't earn out. So mm-hmm. I was in book author jail. That Ugh, cold, dark, lonely place. You know,
it's the worst.
Yeah, where you write things then, and they go all the way up to acquisitions. People love them. And then they say, oh, but...
But your numbers.
So,
are you sure you don't want, to write it under a different name? I had the same
it
thing.
It never crossed my mind. Did somebody actually say that to you? Because nobody said it to me, and it never crossed my mind.
It was always implied. Like, they were always nice about it, but it was like, well, maybe if you wrote it under a different name. And I was just like, dude, I have three names right now. I can't, I don't want to keep doing this. I want to just stick to one thing.
I think I would have totally have done that. Just, it never...
Go to a different name.
I just never thought of it. I don't know why. It just never... There are a lot of things like that, though, where I look back and I'm like, why didn't I think of that at the time?
I think, for me, because I never wrote under my real name to begin with. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, because my real name is Jesse Peterson, J-E-S-S-E, mm-hmm. male spelling, Peterson, S-E-N, which no one ever spells correctly. And so when I started writing for HarperCollins, they didn't want... that name, which was kind of ambiguous, and men who write romance, they don't, the male doesn't generally sell as well, especially at that time. I think it's much more open now. Mm-hmm. If a guy wants to sell romance, if it's good, whatever. So they asked me to come up with a different name. And so I think because I had never written under my real name until I wrote the zombie books, I always knew that was a possibility. It was always out there.
See, for me recently, because I recently said to a author friend, I wish that I didn't write under my real name. Do you know? It never crossed my mind to use a pseudonym. And now in retrospect, sometimes I wish there was a little bit of a separation between the two.
Yeah, it is kind of nice to have that cloak because it's almost like a, I don't like to say a costume because Jess Michaels is still me. It's, you know, but when I'm Jess Michaels out in a public setting or on social media, I mean, it's easy to remind myself, like, I need to put on that coat, that Jess Michaels coat. And it does give you some distance with your, you know, quote, your real life, I guess, is the best way to put it.
So I have a project that I'm working on right now that won't come out till, I think, end of 2019. And it is a pen. And I can say that there is a definite freedom that comes with writing under a pen name than under your real name. Because there's something about the idea of being judged with my real name that is very different than when I write under this pen, because I don't find myself being as stopped by certain things, you know?
I'm, right.
Yeah. So it's really interesting. I've never had that sort of freedom before, and I'm really enjoying it. So I went to...
So because... Yeah. Because the books had sort of, you know, you were in author jail, and that's why you went indie?
Yeah, and then I had a new agent, because the first agent I had, she decided that her career was going to be pretty much the representation of nonfiction authors, and I'm not a nonfiction writer. Right. So it was very amicable. We're still friends. I love her very much, and she's done really well for herself with this nonfiction segment that she represents. So I found an agent who I still work with, Kristen Nelson, who specializes, you know, in fiction writers. And so she was the one who came to me and said, you know, you might want to consider indie. Would you ever consider independently publishing? And I said, well, yeah, I think that I would. And so, and part of the reason was we had gone all the way up to acquisitions with a book that I wrote, and then got to that, oh, but what about her numbers thing? And I had done that, had done that twice before. And so, you know, here I have three manuscripts that eventually became independently published books. And it was about not long after that that I was able to get the first two books back because they reverted, because they did okay, but not fantastic. And so here all of a sudden I have like, what, four or five books that I can release as an independent author. And so that's...
You can get your momentum going, which as an indie author is very, very important. I mean, it's important for everyone. I think it's especially important as an indie author.
Yeah. So that was pretty great to be able to kind of segue right into that. But then I have made every, I think, possible mistake that an indie author can make between there and here. Because, again, it was Kristen who came to me and said, you know, those books have been out for a while. You need to, I know you can write faster than that, so why is it taking you a year to write this next book?
Were you still in just traditional publishing mindset?
Yes.
Because I've found it's very difficult to get out of that. Like, it's taken me a long time. It probably took me the first year and a half to get out of like, and sometimes I still have it. I still have traditional publishing mindsets.
Which is really hard for me to believe, considering how fast and how prolific you are.
Yeah, but you know, I was always quick, and I was always felt like handcuffs with the traditional publishing, because I would beg. I mean, that's how I ended up with the second pen name, was I was writing as Jenna Peterson, writing historical romance, and I said, please, 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 you know, I really want to write more, you know, could I write more than it was a book every 9 months at that point. So some years I'd have two books and some years I'd just have one. And it was, I could see that there was no way to build a career that way. I mean, you couldn't gain momentum. And so I said, can I just write another book a year, please, please, please. And their solution to that was to have me write it under a different name and write it under Red. So I did it as erotic historical romance, which didn't help me build a career, but at least it helped me make more money, because I was having an additional book. And so that's kind of how I ended up with the second pen name. It was a pen name I had written under before, with Red Sage. And so they said, oh, well, since you've already done erotic historical, could you just do it for us? So, I mean, I always was pushing against that barrier that they sort of put up of how much they were willing to publish every year. But, you know, I mean, I have weird pre-order and when it should be released and how I should do, I mean, I think I'm better at it now, but
it's a dance that you have to learn how to do, that's for sure.
Yeah, and it's always changing. Yes. The steps are always changing.
Yeah, so it was Kristen who was like, why is it taking you so long? I know you write faster than this. So the momentum that I had started to build, I let slip away by taking a full year to finish the next book, right?
Right.
So that was the first. And then the next thing was, so I had these Hollywood Girls Club books. I had three of them, and they actually did pretty well, and people seemed to like them and all that. And, you know, now, in retrospect, where I am in my career, the obvious thing to do after writing the third Hollywood Girls Club book is to write another Hollywood.
Right, keep going.
Right? To ride that horse until it dies.
Right.
That's not what I did.
Yeah.
Right? So, yeah. At that point, I thought, wouldn't it be fun to write a billionaire romance?
Right.
So then I hopped off of one thing and hopped onto another, and I did that a couple times. You know, I've got a billionaire series. I have what was, I think, called New Adult, but actually it's just kind of Hollywood-esque, a glamour series. I started a thriller series. I have a small town series. You know, I did that sort of thing that you really shouldn't do as you build a brand, which is hop around to the things that were interesting to me. And,
but it's such a balance, don't you think? Yeah. Because, you know, I mean, having come out of a long 10 book series, which has done really, really well. I mean, it's like, I want to write something different. You know what I mean? I want to take a little rest before I maybe come back into that world, which is sort of the plan at some point, is to come back into that world. So it's like the balance of, I'm riding this horse and it's still alive, and also just wanting to maybe try a different horse just for myself, or maybe walk for a while. So, I mean, that's always the balance, is like what's smart for the career and what's smart for the creative part of my brain.
And you know, what's really interesting is that I remember as an agent in films I would say to directors or to screenplay writers, and my colleagues would say these things to actors: do one for yourself, do one for the studios. So go do an indie that you desperately love, that is small, you know, heartfelt, and then go do the big budget action movie for the studio that keeps you kind of your career up there in the eyes.
Lets you keep eating.
So, and really, I think that circles back to the whole idea of pen names. I think a really good way to do it, it's like, if you think about, you know, when people are spinning plates, you have to get that first plate spinning before you can go start the second one.
Right.
And I think that in retrospect, I maybe didn't have it spinning quite as much as I should have or could have before I started the second one. And then the component of, if you're going to start, if you're going to branch out, you have to decide if you're going so far out that you need to build a new readership, not to confuse your already existing readership.
Right.
You know, and that could mean another name.
You know? Yeah. So, yeah, especially if you're writing something very different. Yeah. I mean, I pretty much just write historical romance. It all has kind of the same tone. So even when I'm writing something different, I'm still writing the same. Versus if I wanted to go out and write a thriller, I would definitely to do a different name. I mean, I would probably go back to my Jesse name just because that would fit that name better. Mm-hmm. My Jesse name, like it's not my real name.
Or use initials but, or something. Cause that's,
yeah, I would do something different just, you know, because I wouldn't want to confuse my audience or disappoint them. Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't want somebody to pick up a Jess Michaels book thinking it's going to be X mm-hmm. and suddenly it's Y and it's always been X. I mean, that's, it betrays the promise that I've set up. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Kind of the same way if you're saying it's a romance, it can't have everyone die in the end.
No.
Twitter.
Not usually, right? Not usually. It's got to have the happiness at the end of it, or at least the
So you still do work as a literary mm-hmm. attorney. I know because you've helped me. So how do you sort of, since you're talking about spinning plates, how do you manage all the plates that you have? Because you have a lot of plates.
Yeah, I really like the saying, another author friend of mine gave it to me recently, discipline is freedom, because it really has to do with structuring my day. So, yeah. And as my practice has grown, it's also been the ability to say to myself, it used to be when I didn't have my legal practice that I would write 3,000 words a day, no matter how long it took. Mm-hmm. And some days that would take, what, 2 or 3 hours? And some sure. days it felt like I sat at my computer for 12 hours mm-hmm. to get my 3,000 words. That's just the way it was. And as the literary practice has grown, because I love it, don't tell the writer part of me, but I love it nearly as much. You know what I mean? Like there's a part of my brain that desperately craves contract review and redlining. Which is funny because
which to the layman sounds like, oh no, why? Yeah,
which is funny because I absolutely hate going in and editing my books, right? So there's something that I get, there's an editorial part of me that I get that when I redline or review a contract that mm-hmm. I definitely don't want to do with my own material as an author. So sure. basically it had to go from I do 3,000 words a day as a writer, no matter what, to I dedicate 2 hours a day to my writing. Mm-hmm. Right? 2 hours a day. It can be, and I get up really, really early. I like to front load my day. So it can be like the hour immediately after I wake up and the hour right before I go to bed. Or if my schedule allows it, it could be 2 hours in the morning or 2 hours in the evening. But basically what I say is I can have 2 hours to write every day. And I treat myself like I'm that client. This is my client time for me. Mm-hmm. I don't always get my 2 hours. You know what I mean? Like some days it'll be an hour. I try to always.
But just knowing that that's how you want to structure it, yeah. I think. And if you do it consistently enough, you can kind of veer off the path. Exactly. Is how I feel.
And then I still think of writing as being as luxurious and something that I dearly, dearly love. So I mm-hmm. will often write on the weekends. You know, yeah. for me, it's not. I guess the downside is that I never really stop working. But when yeah. I'm writing on the weekends, it doesn't really feel like work. It feels more like freedom. Mm-hmm. So. And then, but I do legal stuff on the weekends too. It all seems to work out. And then, you know, I keep my practice, I say boutique, but that's code for small, you right. know, and it's, you know, it's built all by word of mouth and, which allows me a lot of flexibility that I think a lot of people don't get to have. I can kind of pick
right because you're not hustling for the clients because they just come.
They do, and you know, and I try to be really respectful. I don't know if you've noticed or not, but I don't ever. I'm in a lot of writers groups with you, and I don't ever talk about legal stuff in those groups.
Right. Like, no, that's true.
Yeah, and it's intentional because I don't want to ever abuse the gift that I've been given by being in that group with other writers.
Right. Know? Well, it's kind of like going on Goodreads and then mm-hmm. waving your arms around as an author. I mean, like,
you don't do that.
If it comes up, that's great. Mm-hmm. And you can say, because it does come up a lot. I mean, you know, recently somebody asked on one of the groups, I think you're probably in it too. You know, well, I need a literary attorney. Does anyone have a recommendation? It was hilarious to watch 25 of us go, Maggie Marr, Maggie Marr, Maggie Marr, Maggie Marr, Maggie Marr. I was like, I feel like she knows it's probably Maggie Marr. It's so funny. But I mean, it was just so funny. And it's I mean, by this time you and I had scheduled this podcast and I was just laughing because I was like, well, this is clearly going to talk about this because it's hilarious. I mean, it really is the word of mouth. I mean, it speaks so highly of what you do. And I think, like we said at the beginning, I think it really is that as an author, you understand my emotional attachment to my work, and you also understand what are the legalities mm-hmm. in the box that I'm in, because there is a box with a lot of times with the legalities. I mean, there's certain things that I can't mm-hmm. get out of. So, mm-hmm. And that's fine as long as I know what those parameters are.
And that's the thing, is that I think that I come at it too from a different place, where I might say to you or another client, so here are the challenges with this agreement as I see them. I understand that you're going to decide what works for you, but here are all the things that I don't like about this agreement, and here are all the things that I do like about this agreement in comparison mm-hmm. to other agreements I'm seeing in the marketplace, you know, because that's really the gift that I'm given, is kind of a marketplace overview of a lot of things, whether it's publishing, gaming, film and TV, subsidiary rights, all of that. So I can say to you, this is what I'm seeing coming out of audiobooks from the five agreements that I've taken a look at over the past mm-hmm. month. And this agreement is an outlier in these three areas. And it's really right on track on this component, you know? And it took me a long time to understand that is what people really want from me. Mm-hmm. They want me to say, and I had to experience it as somebody who was getting a service from somebody else. Like I had to really step into that moment of being able to say, this is what I see as a stumbling block, but in my opinion, based on the other things that I've witnessed and seen and read, this is really within what is going on in the market. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is key. You have to have seen enough stuff to be able to say, this makes sense. But you also have to be able to know, to understand the law, you know, to be able to say, well, this obviously isn't going to fly, you know, or right. this will. But it's that overview, I think. And also not thinking that creative people don't understand it. I had one client who said, oh, it's so nice to talk to you, because the last attorney I had talked to me like I couldn't understand things. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, here's my experience. I said, I went to law school and I've worked, and I'm a writer too. I've never met a writer that isn't as smart as anyone that I went to law school with.
Right.
You know? So while you maybe didn't go to law school with me, I think that you can understand pretty much anything that I have to explain to you if I explain it. Mm-hmm. You know, but I guess.
Right, because sometimes the terms aren't familiar.
Right.
But as soon as you understand the terms, then you understand the contract. You know, I mean, every mm-hmm. once in a while, because legalese is legalese, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're looking, you're like, I don't understand what this word is. Like, what is it referring to? But as soon as you know what the reference is to, it's like, oh, okay, then I get what it's trying to say.
And I think that might be part of where the comfort level comes in, because I think sometimes it's not that people aren't smart enough, but nobody ever wants to appear stupid. And so since
nobody ever wants to say, I don't get it.
Yeah, so since I'm an author and an attorney, asking me a question isn't quite the same as asking somebody who is, do you know what I mean? Like, since we're in a common tribe in a way, I've heard that before too, that it's easier to ask questions, mm-hmm. you know? So.
Right. Cause it's almost like leaning over to another writer friend going like, do you know what that means?
What does that mean?
The common knowledge that we share with each other, where it's like, she knows.
What does that mean? That part where they said that you have to do blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh yeah, I totally know what that means.
Yeah. You're the friend that knows. You're the friend that did the studying with the rest of us.
I totally know that one. Now, can you explain to me how to get a BookBub ad to work? No.
Exactly. There's a train.
Right. You know what I mean? Like, so maybe that's part of it.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I mean, the thing that I really love is, you know, how willing you are to share information. I mean, obviously, you know, you have your clients and you get paid for that information, and that information is worth what you pay for it. But I mean, you also have a YouTube channel, which is free.
Yeah.
And you did this amazing video, not that recently, but somewhat recently, about long form creators making short form content. And I thought that it was brilliant.
Thank you. Yeah.
And you have a whole bunch of videos about that. Those kinds of topics, which I think if anybody is looking for just kind of general information, that's kind of outside of what we normally talk about. Because mm-hmm. there is kind of a normal conversation that authors have. And I think sometimes you go out of the box, which I love, because it makes me think about different things.
It's so funny that you mentioned that, because another author friend said to me recently, because I kind of stopped. I traveled this summer and I stopped doing them. And she was like, when are you going to start doing that again? And I said, I really need to start doing those again, because those are really fun. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot. I mean, right now is an amazing time as a creative individual, because if you can create things, there are so many different ways that you can capitalize on that. You know?
Yeah, I mean, that's what I wanted to talk to you about is there's so much diversification. Mm-hmm. You and I, again, we just kind of touched on this before we started recording, but there's not only just, you could do traditional, you could be a hybrid, you could do indie. There are different ways you can publish mm-hmm. indie. You could, you know, put something in KU, you could do something wide. You have audio, you have all those things that are kind of normal, but then there's all these other options. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's so many more movies being made of romance novel, mm-hmm. you know, adaptations. There's games, there's a thousand things. So, I mean, there's so much control of content that we can do right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a really vibrant time. And it's what's always interesting to me is that I will, you know, I get a lot of phone calls and I talk to anybody, you know, about anything that they want to ask questions about, you know, because I figure mm-hmm. that's everybody in our community, the romance community, gives. Do you know?
Yes.
Like they just do. Like I could call you or any number of people with any question and people would sit there and talk to you about it. You know, mm-hmm. that's just the way we are. So I have a knowledge base and I'm happy to share it any way that I possibly can, you know? So the idea, I had somebody call me recently and she said, you know, this producer has sent me this email and I'm kind of scared to talk to them. And I said, well, here's the thing. Until you sign something, you own the book. You know, you can talk to them for forever, but as long as you don't like sign a piece of paper that they send to you, you are golden.
Right.
You know, and whether it's me or another attorney, and I can give you five other names to talk to them about it, five other attorneys to talk to about it, just have somebody else look at the piece of paper before you sign it. That's all you have
right.
to do. But there is kind of this, you know, this fear of what if I give something away or what if I get locked into something or what, you know, but authors and creators are smart people, you know, they're really smart people. And so I'm always like, talk to whoever you want. Chat with them, see what they have to say. You know,
I feel like too that sometimes it's kind of that knee-jerk reaction. Maybe that's one of the things I carry from traditional publishing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, the contracts were, I mean, they weren't predatory because of the time. I mean, they were, mm-hmm. I guess, but the time that they were in, they were what you had, mm-hmm. and so having lost rights to things mm-hmm. that I feel like I can't retrieve, it's very hard for me to want to give anything to anyone,
right?
Ever,
right?
Because I don't want to lose it.
Yeah. And that makes perfect sense. And I think that when you get to that stage where somebody actually sends you a piece of paper, you definitely need to have somebody look at it. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. I would never not have somebody look at paper.
But I do think that, you know, as a creator of content, somebody, if you're somebody who, whatever you create, whatever content that is, if somebody has interest in it, take the phone call, chat with mm-hmm. them, see what they have to say. You know, I get a ton of calls where somebody will call me up and say, so-and-so called me. Are they real? And I can say, well, and I'll tell them what I know about that person. Well, this is what I know. This is what I think they've done. Or I've never heard of them, but that doesn't mean they're not real. You know, what is it that they were after? What was the language they used? You know, there are certain ways that you can kind of tell, you know,
yeah.
what's going on. And I'm happy to be that resource because, you know, I feel like all of us in this community do that for each other. You know?
Yeah, if we can help each other, I mean, you know, we always kind of, Jen and mm-hmm. I always kind of joke about it with pie, you know, it's not like pie. Mm-hmm. It's not like there's eight pieces and then everybody who's had a piece, then nobody else gets any. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like a never ending supply of pie. Mm-hmm. So if I help you and I give you I help mm-hmm. you and that makes you get a bigger piece of pie, it doesn't mean I'm going to get a smaller piece of pie.
Mm-hmm. No.
And I think that we kind of get that maybe because of the RWA mentality, you know, where obviously the organization has its issues, but for the most part, it's always been about helping each other.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so we have that base of like, of course I'm going to help you.
And the other part is that, you know, I can't write a Jess Michaels book mm-hmm. and you can't write a Maggie Marr book. And we have readers that read a book a day and I can't service readers that read a book a day, at least not yet. You know what I mean? Like I don't have that many books, you know, and even you with all those books can only service them for about 3 months. You know what I mean? So,
and they would have to consistently read right, everything.
Right. So romance is such a vast ocean of
yes.
readers and it's such a big business that I think that a lot of people or the people that I call my friends subscribe to a rising tide lifts all boats.
Yes.
You know, that idea that I have these thousands of readers who like my stuff. You write stuff that's similar. I think they might like your stuff. They should know you as an author too. You know,
yeah.
that idea.
Right.
So,
yeah, that mentality of, oh, you're out of stuff to read for me. Cool, you should read Maggie, mm-hmm. or you should read this person. You should read this person. And, you know, it doesn't take away from me at all.
No, in fact, the thing is...
It helps.
Yeah, because I have friends that are... A lot of friends who are not writers that are readers. And if they recommend a book to me by an author that I've never read before, that's the first book I buy. It's like anybody. Mm-hmm. It's word of mouth is huge. You know, yep. If somebody tells me, oh, I love this book. I'm like, oh, well, what was it? You know, because I'm a reader first. I love to read. I still love it so much.
I'm very excited because I do have time right now on the sabbatical. I'm like, I'm reading.
I know. You really are feeling that well because I found
I'm going to fill that well so yeah, hard.
Yeah. That when I feel like a little bit tapped out, it's the reading that makes me.
That refreshes you.
Feel ready to write again. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you see as the next big thing that authors should be thinking about?
Oh, you know what? So it's so funny. I love the idea of author as creator. And I know not everybody will probably embrace this or want to do it. But I have this idea that another author and I are thinking about doing. You know, for a while, authors were creating almost like book trailers.
Yeah.
And I think that there is a different way to do that. And what I think is what I want to do as an experiment is that every chapter in a book has a pivotal conversation, right? It's the mm-hmm. high point of that chapter. And, you know, it might be 2 to 4 pages of dialogue in a chapter, which is, you know, if you film it, if you say it's a minute a page, which it won't be because, you know, if you lift the dialogue from a book, it's not going to fill a full page of screenplay. So mm-hmm. like that pivotal conversation in a chapter is probably maybe 30 seconds to a minute and a half on screen. So my idea is, or an idea is to take those pivotal conversations from the first 3 chapters and turn that into a trailer. Do you know? So that it acts almost like the way a pre-read does. Like, you know how Amazon will let you look at 10% of the book to see if you want to buy it? It's kind of like that, only in a visual component. So mm-hmm. I love the idea of storytellers having more of an ability to take their written word and turn it into visual if they want. Or what else I'm starting to see are, you know, the idea that instead of an audiobook just being read by one voice actor, that it's almost like they're going back to the original formula of, and you see it in podcasts and some audiobooks as well, where they're casting the book.
Yeah.
And they're doing the interactive, more interactive.
It's almost like a radio, mm-hmm, a radio play show, at that point.
A radio play. And I love that idea as well. What I want to layer onto that, which is kind of funny because, is I want to actually see the people in the booth doing the radio play. Mm-hmm. Like, I want to see the whole thing. I don't know why. And that almost makes it reality, though. So that's kind of weird.
I don't know, though, because, you know, having done the custom photo shoots with Jen LeBlanc, and, you know, I mean, the one thing I did not expect going and doing it for the first time was how much it would influence my creativity to see a person that I picked, that I cast as my hero, the person that I picked and I cast as my heroine, putting them into costume because, you know, Regency costume is very specific, and having them move around together in the way that I'm asking them to do is massively powerful for my creative process. I feel like I can't necessarily do it without it now. I mean, I could, but I like doing it with that. That's really important to my creative process now. So, I mean, I think it's something in the same way because, I mean, if you say, oh, this person's Hugh Jackman, you know, I mean, when you look at a picture, my hero's a Hugh Jackman. I think of Hugh Jackman as Wolverine, and that's not very Regency. Versus, you know, if I have a model or an actor that I've put into that costume and the way that they move is the way that I now picture the way that character moving. I mean, I think it's really the same thing, and giving that experience to the reader is a really interesting idea.
And the idea that, you know, that with a phone and a computer, in theory, you can create these little vignettes or tiny sort of things, whether they're visual or they're auditory, or even if they're written, where people are interacting with the content you're creating.
Yeah.
And I find that just so amazing. as a storyteller. And, you know, I think the example that I go back to a lot is, you know, like if you look at Issa Rae, who has Insecure on HBO, which is this fabulous show that I'm desperately in love with. She started out, I think, in college doing like these 30-second to 2-minute YouTube, like it was a YouTube series. I think it was like Diary of an Awkward Black Girl, or it was something like that. But so, but that gave her her chops. Like they were filming it, they were editing it, they were doing all the stuff of these tiny little almost vignettes, right? They were mini episodes that eventually I think that's what turned into Insecure, which is this amazing show that is 30 minutes in length. So not to say that you would have to take your career to be, you know, this HBO goddess that I love your show, but the whole idea that we can tell our stories in multiple ways.
Right.
Through direct distribution, you know, like I could, in theory, start a show and directly distribute it to YouTube every single day. That's pretty brilliant, you know?
Well, and you know, at minimum, by creating extra content in a shorter form, you're creating content for your social media, which is such a big way that we push. I mean, I know that, you know, every time we do these extra photographs that aren't the cover photographs and I make memes, and those get a lot of push. You know, people are excited to see those extra pictures, extra hand and on the hip, the extra abs, whatever, you know, whatever they're into that day. You know, anytime that I can create something that's extra, it gives me more content, not just in what I created, but also in how I'm distributing it out and how I'm pushing that book.
And whether I think we realize it or not, any content that we create as content creators makes us, gives us a greater depth to our ability to continue to create great content. You know what I mean? So you standing there in the photo shoot, you're talking about how that fills your well. Well, that makes you, that it, that informs your writing, you know?
Absolutely.
So everything, I think, if you're someone who wants, and it, maybe that's part of it, is that it's a great time to be a creator and to be creative. And nobody's restricted by gatekeepers in the same way that they were even 3, 5, 10, 15, 20 years ago, you know? Because anybody...
Yeah, there's a real push for direct distribution.
And it allows everybody to have a voice, you know?
Right. Everybody can have a voice.
Yeah.
If you're willing to put in the work.
That's the thing, is that sometimes I find... You know, and I think everybody does, constrained by time. It's not even money, you know, because if you have a an iPhone and a computer, you can do a lot of stuff, you know. But time is so precious, for sure.
Well, and I think, too, that sometimes people are worried it's not going to be worth it if there is money involved. You know, I mean, it is a big swallow to do the custom shoot. It is a lot of money. But, you know, once you've actually done it, you realize there's so many levels of value to it. And it's the same thing with just that, you know, the time that you put in, you know, is it going to be worth it? It's very, because our time is so precious and our money is so precious that it's very difficult to make the leap the first time.
Yeah.
So sometimes maybe it is like kind of seeing someone else do it and say, oh, you know, hearing their experience of it, which is why, again, it's so great that we all talk.
It's true. And then also I love the idea that, it's funny, you don't always know exactly where the path is taking you, you know?
Yeah.
So, but it can be an organic sort of journey. So, you know, I didn't necessarily know that starting in that mailroom was going to lead to me having a career as an author and as someone who helps people get things made in film and TV and does their legal contracts, right? I didn't know that's where it was going to go. But now that I'm here, I love being in this seat. You know, I love all the components of it. But it definitely didn't lead to exactly where I thought it was going to go, you know?
Maybe that's it, is the people that succeed are flexible enough to let the path take them sometimes. Like to control the things that you can control when you can control it, but also be open to just flowing down the river.
Yeah, I try to do that. We were talking about that earlier, about, you know, just letting it go.
It is the big challenge.
It is. It is.
Because I think, you know, we are all a little bit control freaks.
Type A? No.
Us? No. Well, we're out of time. I don't know. Okay. These hours go by so fast. Do you want to tell anyone who's listening about your latest book or your next book and where everybody can find it?
Oh, that's very kind of you. Yeah. So the latest book that I finished was Vicious Glamour, which is set in the world of Hollywood. And I have a book series called The Glamour Series. And there's been this penultimate bad girl who's been the antagonist for all of the books. And her name's Kylie Kepner, and she finally gets her book. And that book was really hard for me to write. That was one of those things, because as I was writing Kylie's story, because she said she's your ultimate mean girl, but there are reasons why she's so mean. And so I had to go through all of that with her, and they are really dark reasons as to why she's so mean. And so that's out. That came out the beginning of October, and I really love it. And it's available on all distributors. You can find it at Apple Books, Amazon, Kobo, Google Play, Barnes & Noble. Anywhere that you can find an ebook, you can find it. It's Vicious Glamour. And then the next book, I'm not sure. I'm keeping a tight lips on that one, because I have an idea. And I don't know if you experience this too, but sometimes I can't talk about the idea until I feel like the idea is formed.
Right.
It takes the air out of the balloon somehow.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. See, I'm a big blabbermouth. I'm just like, I thought of a thing, and then I did.
Yeah. So I thought of a thing.
I should be more tight-lipped.
And I think it's going to be a trilogy. And I think it'll be like three books. It's not going to be a ginormous series. It's going to be like a trilogy of books. And I've started to work on what that's going to look like. And I think that the first book will come out the end of first quarter 2019.
So, cool. Well, we'll have to look for that.
And then, you know what? Anywhere, if you type in Maggie Marr, I have a website. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Facebook. All of that
YouTube.
Stuff. YouTube. Yeah. LinkedIn. I like to post things on LinkedIn. That's another place that I like. So.
Yeah. See, I can't with LinkedIn.
Yeah.
But you have a different, again, you have very different.
That's true.
You've got a different thing going.
Yeah.
So. Well, thank you so much for coming. I'm so glad we got to do this.
Thank you for having me. It's awfully nice of you. Thank you so much.
Well, I enjoyed it. This was really good.
I did too.
This has been Journeys of Romance. I'm Jess Michaels, your host. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next time.